Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Okay, so as mentioned on this evening's Wednesday Night Rugby, we have a special guest. I am very happy to say that he's usually a busy man and tricky to get hold of, but Owen Redden has made some time for us. Good evening.
Hi, Joe. How are you getting on?
Very well. How are you getting on? I know, without breaching too much confidence, I know you were running around helping out a couple of family members earlier on today and delivering meals, and this is the world we find ourselves in now.
Yeah. I was down visiting my dad in Limerick for an hour, dropping off some meals to get him through a few more days. I suppose he's 80, so he's looking after himself. And my wife is due here in the next few weeks with number four, so a lot going on. So got some stuff down to him today that might see him through a few weeks anyway.
And has work stopped entirely? I mean, we'll touch on work and all that kind of business a bit later on. But in the main, are you busy as ever and working from home, or have you got your feet up?
Yeah, so we're well set up. I work with an aircraft leasing company, and I suppose our customers are airlines all over the world. And my particular customers are in Turkey and Russia and France. So they're all working from home as well. But it's a very tough time for the airlines, who are certainly, you know, big partners of ours in making the day-to-day work for everybody. So basically it's endless calls of finding out ways of, you know, getting through the next few months and making sure as many of them survive and come out the other end or in a position to actually thrive the next few months, I suppose.
I wanted to chat to you a bit about your own career, if that's okay, because I don't think actually we really had you on even when you retired in 2016. And I knew you had an excellent career. You've actually sneakily had an extraordinary career. You know, when you reel off the stats of everything you've been involved in, 385 professional games, plenty more if we throw in AIL, but 385 professional games, 71 Ireland caps. That had passed me by, I'm sorry. Sorry to say, I didn't realize you'd got up to 71. And then we're talking 2 Six Nations, three Heineken Cups, two Pro 12 titles as they were then, a premiership as well, obviously, with Wasps, and a European Challenge Cup. That's a hell of a haul, actually, when you stack up the numbers.
Yeah, you were probably doing what most of my colleagues do, Joe, and reference the number of minutes I actually played for Ireland, which is why I passed you by. I think, you know, some days now, as even chatting with my dad today at lunch, you know, you look back and probably you're a little bit happier or prouder of what you did than when you were in it. You know, you're constantly struggling or fighting for the next thing and wanting more all the time. To sit back and look back now, and because he knew I was coming on, so he was, you know, having a similar chat that you just said there. And yeah, it is pretty unbelievable. It sounds like you're talking with someone else. But yeah, I suppose life goes on. I don't know. It was great. Really enjoyed it, and I don't miss it, but I did enjoy it for sure.
And so we mentioned your dad. Hopefully, he sat at home listening with the feet up. Was he a big part of your career? Was he a rugby fan? Was he kind of, you know, watching every game or keeping an eye on games, or was he a bit more hands off?
Oh, he was definitely hands on. I think I could probably count the games he missed. You know, there was numerous occasions where, you know, I remember like some special ones where, like, we had a Thursday night match in Cardiff, which was completely, you know, off the beaten track in terms of scheduling that he showed up at unexpectedly. There was another one where we played the All Blacks. Ireland played the All Blacks in the Aviva, but I was left out late on a Tuesday for that game, wasn't selected. And, you know, he showed up in Italy on Saturday watching me off the bench playing Treviso, you know, with 35 people at the game, and had arranged to go to the New Zealand game originally. So, no, he was certainly very much involved, and, you know, regularly would still go to Thomond Park or up to the sports ground now, and still, you know, made a few of Leinster's away games this year as well. So certainly a huge rugby fan, still is.
That's amazing. I mean, you wouldn't blame any father for going to the All Blacks game that weekend.
No, and it certainly went full circle, like near the end of my career, when you have that many games played and you really want to you know, deliver a performance of meaning or get emotionally into a position where you can actually play a physical sport that, you know, in a game that, say, you take that Treviso game, you know, there's people playing their first game that day, and it's very important that you, whether it's your first or 100th or whatever, that you're equally committed. Him coming to those games certainly helped me, for sure. And, you know, there's probably key moments in some of those games that maybe you get it, you kind of are turning points. The way sport is, you know, there are big moments, and if you get them right, you go for another year or whatever. And I think there was a few of those moments where he was certainly present and certainly had an impact.
And I know you think deeply about all aspects of the game, and your preparation, I'm sure, was something you thought a lot about over the extent of your career. Would you channel things like dads in the crowd and get emotional for games that way, or was that unhelpful?
So it would depend, really. On games where I felt, you know, I was about to, you know, go overboard or lose the head, or I didn't have any work to do to emotionally get into that game, you just stay calm and you know, go as far as reading a book in the dressing room about, you know, I'm talking like 15 minutes before the, or like 5 minutes before the warm up, something completely like fiction that would be just completely off the wall. You've done the work. What you got to do now is rest up and rest your mind and then get ready to play. And then there'll be other games where there'll be completely the wrong approach, you know, like say Thursday night in Cardiff, you know, in the rain, it's not, you can't be going out into that game just thinking it'll happen. So it would be, if I needed it, I'd use it. And if I didn't, I would try and dull it down, yeah, and try and find a kind of common, consistent approach to each game. At the start, I think you probably get overhyped. I certainly would have been someone who in the early part of my career, would have found that. And looking back, it was something I needn't have worried about. I mean, I was always up for games, and thinking you needed to be even more up for them was very unhelpful, I think, in my first 2 years, particularly in the position I was playing in. You know, but it's slowly but surely, I think it dawns and you get to overcome those things.
And do you mean what you said there, literally, like you'd be reading a John le Carré 15 minutes before the warm-up?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, it's quite comforting in some ways. Like, you know, if you're in a Highland Cup final or semi-final and you're reading some, you know, absolute Dan Brown novel with 10 minutes to go through warm-up, it's quite calming that in your own head you think, this is how ready I am, you know, and everyone around me is getting ready in the dressing room, there's fans in the crowd, and I know this is coming now, and I don't have to do anything except sit here. I'm ready, and you know, it was certainly, you know, a scrum half position where you need to be instinctively playing what you see, and having plans about I'm going to pass or I'm going to kick or I'm going to run are not good, not helpful. So you need to be in a very calm state of mind where you get into a flow situation, I suppose, where decisions are happening. You're moving on from each one, whether it be the right one or the wrong one. I think having as few thoughts as possible, and, you know, if the plan was to stay calm as opposed to you know, overplaying one aspect of the game.
Prime yourself to be ready to react and get into that state of flow, I guess, is the real skill, as you said, especially in your position. And, you know, we mentioned the Ireland career then, 71 caps, you know, 3 World Cups. You'll think this is another dig or something your teammates might laugh at. I don't mean it that way. Because of that's your 70, it. Of your that's 70, of your 71 caps, say 45 are off the bench. You have to get good at being a substitute. I mean, you have to be ready to make an impact when you come on. So over time, you know, those minutes where you're watching before you come on, when you got good at it, how did you use the 50, 60, 65 minutes you had on the bench?
Yeah, I suppose, like, there's a few parts of that. I think the first part of the week is you know, dealing with the disappointment of not getting picked. I never, ever felt, and maybe, you know, I look back some days and I have thinking, God, if I'd settled into that and actually, you know, seen me on the bench as being part of the plan and, you know, and basically maybe approach it the way you are looking at it there, that I would have been happier and maybe, you know, it would have been easier for coaches and people who may have wished that of me, that I would just be happy to see it as a big role and play it that way. Whereas the opposite was probably true right to the end, whereby I felt if I delivered well and played well, I'd put myself in position for next week. And then when you're not picked, you deal with that. You know, and start that process again. Now, there's positives to that too. I mean, you can help a team when you're someone who's close to the team who doesn't get picked. You can have a huge impact that week because people will, for a day or two after it's been announced, they'll watch you. You know, like, or take someone like Rob Kearney, for example, where the week he didn't get picked for Ireland, you can be sure when he walked into the dressing room on Monday, the eyes are on you. How are you in the gym session? You know, and you can actually play a much bigger part in things around you and when you're being watched. I think if you look at Devon Toner not being picked for the World Cup and the kind of noises coming out of Leinster about how well he reacted, and like, what a lesson to be teaching, you know, young people for the future who don't get picked for World Cups and who have huge disappointments. I mean, it's invaluable for Leo to have someone doing that, you know, is just huge. So there's that side of it where you can help the team as a substitute by reacting in the right way earlier on in the week. You know, you probably need to talk to the coach to have to square that away, because it's unrealistic for you to be bouncing around when there's unresolved issues in your head. So, you want to talk to the coach and find out why and work that so that you're moving closer to getting picked, but at the same time you're delivering for your teammates. And then once the game kicks off, I suppose it's the same thing. You need to kind of watch your emotions. You know, if the team are playing well and going and pulling away, like, you need to be very careful that you're not kind of falling into this celebration mode, or because even if you're on for the thing about Ireland careers are, you know, you could get 15 seconds and have to make a tackle, a pass or a kick. And if you don't deliver, you know, that's judged and that's life and you won't play the next week. So there's pressure on the bench that I'm not sure, I think people sometimes don't fully get. And I mean, actual players, how important, you know, if you get 3 minutes, it sounds ridiculous, but for your own career, those 3 minutes happen to be extremely important. It's all the coach got to see you that week, really. They do pay attention to training, but, you know, it's important to deliver when you're on if you want to keep your own personal career going, you know, and it's important to deliver in the week if you want to keep the wheels on the bus for the whole group going, and together you can go and achieve some of the things you mentioned at the start, you know, winning trophies and things like that.
Yeah.
You need really everybody buying in that way.
And did that, you know, so out of 71 appearances, 45 of them, you have that kind of little mini bereavement on the Tuesday or whenever the team is named. Did that make Ireland in some ways a bit of a fight and a bit of a struggle for you, and a bit of a, you know, a lot of tough weeks actually, because it was kind of went parallel with a degree of disappointment? Or was it thoroughly enjoyable and you weren't kind of spending too much of your time having to deal with things being so close to how you might ideally want them?
No, I think, I don't know if it started out that I enjoyed that, but in the end, like, you know, I enjoyed the fight. Like, I knew I was in a fight for position, but I enjoyed the outcome was good or bad, but I certainly enjoyed, you know, having something to fight for every week and every training session and every minute of the match. You know, having something that close was great, you know, and yes, you have to deal with disappointments and that's life. But you get good at like, if I was starting at the start of my career, I would have assumed the fight would leave me at some point, you know, like, why? But I think if, you know, certain people enjoy that aspect of, like, it's a bit like if you're playing every week and you enjoy the kind of the fight, you know, the physical fight you have with the opposition, or the physical confrontation you have with the opposition, or it's the same thing. You don't win every week, you don't lose every week, but those losses don't make you not want to play the game. And same for me, I didn't win selection every week or lose selection every week, but the losses never made me want to give up or stop. It was just something I had to deal with. And you know, whether you're starting and you're motivated completely by, you know, the game that's coming, or you're trying to get onto the team, and you have two things that you're motivated by, you know, getting onto the team and look, and even if you're on the team, you're motivated by staying on the team for sure. So
yeah.
You know, it's just about dealing with the disappointment, and if you enjoy the fight, it's okay, you know. And for me, I was lucky enough that through that period I did. Now, you know, you can't be guaranteed that. Obviously, you don't know mentally how you're going to be all the time. But mostly in my career, I was up for that.
One last Ireland question I wanted to ask you: given that you've been at 3 World Cups, and we're off the back of a very disappointing World Cup finale to the Joe Schmidt era, which was so successful, obviously. I appreciate 07, 11 and 15 are all very different. So this is kind of a tricky question. But is there any trend that you spotted which might give even a clue as to why Ireland certainly haven't, you couldn't say they've ever overachieved at a World Cup. They may not have underachieved. Like, I, you know, if you say to me in 15 injuries decimated the team for the Argentina game, it was, you know, just a tough scenario. I couldn't really disagree with that. And equally, 07 is not the norm. But what those 3 World Cups all have in common is Ireland never overachieved in the way of Wales might tend to at a World Cup, or France can pull it together for a World Cup. What is it, do you suspect, if there is a trend across the three of them, that might be something we could look at as a rugby country?
I don't know, really, because three is such a small number.
Sure.
You know, if you took three outcomes in any kind of assessment, it's such a small number to actually be assessing Irish rugby.
But it's all you've got, so it's what I'm giving you.
Yeah.
Maybe there wasn't a trend. Maybe that's your takeaway.
Well, like 2007 was you know, 2007, we had some horrendously bad performances at the start of the competition, which put us on the back foot. And there is a level of expectation in Ireland in the media that has to be addressed. The level of expectation, the level of pressure, the gap between, you know, at that point in time, what is a good outcome and what isn't. And, you know, in 2007, we like the expectations in the media were huge. And then, you know, the delivery at the start was very bad and we were on the back foot. And then it kind of spiraled out of control. You know, it seemed to get very negative very quickly. You know, and look, there's loads of different reasons. Like, I'm rather than thrashing them all out again, we were undercooked, or we were staying far away, or, you know, all those things in isolation you can overcome, you know, but not hitting the ground running and having, you know, an easy game or two that we managed to perform in and win and get a bit of momentum and a bit of unity is a big deal. I think so 2007 was bad from that point of view. And I think there were lessons learned in terms of, you know, actual miles on the clock leading into the World Cup, like nearly losing to Italy in Ravenhill is not a good preparation.
Right? Sure.
And then 2011 was, you know, I think excellently well, a very well-run competition. You know, when we got beaten by Wales and on the day and didn't play well, you know, I thought, you know, it's why did we lose that game? I mean, I could give you, apart from picking the wrong scrum half, which, no, but I mean, why, like, you know, I think you're clutching at straws when you focus on that game, because that was a very good tournament, you know, like we beat Australia away and in New Zealand, and there was great team spirit and everything was moving along really well. I think it was a successful World Cup that we came unstuck in one game. And then 15 was the same, you know, we had that many injuries and we got caught against Argentina. You know, I think in general, I think, you know, there's a mixture of going forward where you have to plan impeccably how you're going to deliver at a World Cup, which I think we do. And then I think you've got to stay in the present and you've got to be very brave when you actually get there. So if you go from getting, you know, at 2007, where you get the 4 years leading into the World Cup wrong and you kind of are slightly wrong, or the last year leading into the World Cup wrong, and then Eddie gives some good feedback and everybody learns, and then Declan gets the benefit of that and manages the structure where you lead really well into the tournament. Then when you get to the tournament, you have to still be adaptable and be able to survive what's happening right in front of you and make sure that you don't let those plans kind of, you know, overtake what's happening. So, for example, you know, while it's important to have a year plan, what you did last January the 1st is like absolutely irrelevant compared to the Friday before that match on the Saturday, you know? Yeah. So like if you show up at the World Cup and you watch the first round of games and trends are changing, you know, and games are actually going a little bit differently and the referees a bit differently and people are kicking more, defending more, whatever.
Yeah.
I think you need to be brave as a coach when you look at what you've got. And I'm only saying this in hindsight now, like looking back at the World Cup, this was something I thought at the end of it. I was like, you know, how do you take the lessons from this World Cup and move forward and bring the level of planning that Joe and Declan and have brought to these World Cups? And then you also bring a massive adaptability. I think from 15 to 19 was about strength and depth, right? I think from 19 to 2023 is, you know, yeah, we have our strength and depth. We know we got a plan long into the future. And then the third one is let's stay in the present when we're there. Let's be the team that's brave enough to change, or that's good enough to change. You know, like that you've got the kind of people that you can change late and make adaptions, adapt.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately that's probably what the biggest lesson is, you know, because the trends in the game do change and staying with them is important.
No, that's an interesting point. And you know, because so for so much of 19, there was a hope that, well, Joe will magic something out, or maybe he's got something in his back pocket. And actually, we kind of stayed the course as a team, it seemed, in the main, and it didn't serve us so well. Yeah. To change pace for a second, just to jog people's memory, you're at Munster 03 to 05. They decide to cut you loose. Wasps come, you do 4 years at Wasps, Heineken Cup winner there, Premiership winner there, then back to Leinster, as people will certainly remember from 09 to 16. When Munster, you know, with I presume Peter Stringer and maybe Tomás O'Leary coming on the scene, said, listen, Owen, we love the cut of your jib, but we're sorry. Was your future guaranteed? Like, were you hot stuff, hot property? Did you have various offers? Where were you at that stage? Because Wasps seems from afar like a really, really good move, really big move.
Yeah, it was a huge opportunity. That no, and I wasn't secure anyway. You know, I had put a few good seasons together in Connacht before I'd been to Munster, and then I didn't really play very much in Munster, so there was no real there was no chance of a club seeing me in Munster, really. You know, what had happened was that when I went to Munster, there was interest from Wasps, and I suppose I'd grown up dreaming about playing for Munster, to be honest with you. And for me, even though I think at the time it was a tough challenge, like I knew I was going to be down the pecking order. I was told that joining there, but I wanted to go and give it everything I had, and then see what happened. So I went there knowing that and spent 2 years there, and you know, I didn't play very often. So I was up against it when I was told, I think it was January out in UL there, you know, I had a meeting with Gareth Fitzgerald and was told that, you know, it was time to move on, really, you know, and which was devastating for definitely a devastating time. You know, I was pretty hurt by it, and maybe, you know, in my own mind, maybe should have seen it coming, but probably didn't. So I spent a week kind of not sure what would happen, but then you know, Wasp did come in, they expressed interest the year before. All the time since seeing me playing a few games for Connacht, we'd played against them in a pre-season friendly that had gone well. And then they'd seen, you know, a few minutes of one of my games that I played for Munster off the bench, and decided, look, we've similar to the Munster chat, really, like we've an open slot here. We've four or five scrum halves. The money's not great. Do you want to come over and give it a go, you know? Right. And I suppose from that point, I said yes, you know, on the phone, which actually helps sometimes, because it's actually, you know, quite, coach feels quite good about it when you can say that, you know, it didn't bother me what I wanted to give it a go. So, and then I spent the next few months digging into why I hadn't succeeded in Munster, what I needed to change, how I needed to develop. And I probably arrived, to be fair, at Wasps, like I arrived in a much better shape as a scrum half who was ready to play and deliver for a side in the Premiership or the Pro 14 or a Heineken Cup than I was when I left Munster in January, to be fair. And that was basically around passing and the practice I went through for those 3 or 4 months, figuring I had a massive, you know, I had one shot left and I needed to change something.
So was your passing not up to scratch?
It was pretty good, but I mean, up to scratch is not as a scrum half. It's something as well that for young scrum halves coming through, like there's no development period when you play a province, you know, like, so you join a team and you've got Keith Earls on the wing, or you've got, you know, Easton Asiwa on the wing, you know, outside four other players right between you and them, and you might be getting your first shot, but the development can be around lots of things, like maybe it can be around your temperament or your kicking, but if you can't actually deliver, you know, a pass that is actually, like, it's not a development. It's got to be there and ready. That's the part of your game that has to actually be rolling out. And it needs to be rolling out at a level like that is kind of like people should see when a young nine plays, you know, unless people in the stand are saying, like, kind of noticing every pass that's actually, you know, jeepers, that looks sharp. I don't think you're quite there. And I think I left Munster, where you'd, and like Peter Stringer was a great example. You know, you could, no matter how many times you saw him play, you'd say, "Ooh, there's a good one." You know.
It's funny. So, we had we'd him and O'Gara on the show 2 weeks ago, kind of chatting about their relationship, and O'Gara was saying he used to just say to Stringer all the time, you know, obviously they grew up together in many ways. He said, "If that ball is not stinging my hands, then you need to do something about it. I want that ball stinging my hands. And I'll tell you if it's too hot, but I want it as hot as you can give it to me."
Yeah. And that's it. You know, so if you picture a development scrum half for someone trying to learn the ropes and playing with Raj, like, you know, straight after the game, the coach says to Raj, "How did they go?" Like, unless the ball is stinging his hands, he's going to say, "No, not ready yet." You know, and that's the mentality I think, you know, I wasn't in before. I was a scrum half who felt like I could kick, I could run. I was kind of kid yourself into thinking, you know, God, what's wrong? Why haven't I, you know, pushing through? And the real answer was, say, Peter was the gold standard. I wasn't there. And after that, whoever was second or third was kind of like rolling the dice, because none of us were ever going to be delivering at that level. So you're kind of taking a chance by not having it at that level, you know? And I think by the time I went that summer to us, I was in a different spot.
How do you sharpen up your passing then?
So you look at the way golfers, you do things, whether, you know, golfers have different ways. You know, they might have a target they have to hit, or a distance, or a target they have to hit 10 times in a row, and you might get 7 or 8, and then the pressure's on for 9 and 10, and then you do this endlessly over a day until, which could be overtraining, obviously, so you can't do this a lot, but then you know, you might be there for an hour or two, and you're thinking, and you get to 8, this pressure on you for 9 and 10, and you might only have, you give yourself 5 shots or 10 shots, and you have to live with the failure then the next day, you know. And these things that at 22, 23, I'd never heard of. So at that point, I would have just have been throwing balls thinking that's fine, you know, whereas then I moved to a point where, okay, there's a target I have to hit that far away. And at the moment I'm getting like 2 out of 10, you know, how could I measure this and move on? It's very like, you know, you'd hear in business or whatever, you know, having smart, measurable goals that you can actually rank and see if you achieve them. You know, it's obvious stuff, but you don't, it doesn't dawn on you, or it hadn't dawned on me at that point, whether it was immaturity or whatever. But those few months were a big change. So when I arrived there, you know, straight away, I think I was aiming to try and, you know, be in a position where I could play with Raj and he'd feel like my passing was good enough. And I was joining a team where, you know, that maybe wasn't expected of their scrum halves at that point. So I was able to give them something that maybe they weren't expecting to get from me when I got there.
Okay, very interesting. So you've got kind of Ian McGeachan there and Sean Edwards. Edwards, I mean, he's still at it. He still knows how to get a team in the right frame of mind, as we've seen over the last couple of months in France. So in terms of what either of those, I mean, I don't want to suggest they both gave you massive things in your game, but did either of those have a significant influence on shaping the Owen Redden who went back to Leinster?
They absolutely did. It's probably a little bit different in terms of when I came back here. Like there was a huge emphasis on a few different things. Like Sean is actually, you know, he was a halfback in rugby league and you know, had lots of, if you were open to it, had like a one-on-one type relationship with the scrum halves, you know, and was open to that all the time and wanted to get involved and wanted to help out. And, you know, he brought on a whole new level of kind of thinking about passing. So like I had this, you know, ideas around, like I was explaining a minute ago, like golfing, like practicing where you've so many shots or whatever. And then I got over there and I played one match and like I was trying to get the ball out quickly to another one of my teammates, and there's someone in my way. And like, so we're going through the video next week and he was like, what are you doing here? And I was saying, oh, your man's in front of me. And he kind of grabbed me like and brought me outside and put me in front of a bin. Like I'm talking a wheelie bin, you know, and was like, pass me the ball. And I was like, well, I don't really help, you know. And he was like, pass me the ball over the bin. So I ended up doing this stuff over the bin. And like, that was his way. And I'm talking like instantly. So watching a video with him one-on-one to out of the room, into the car park, over the bin, like 10 passes. And he kind of walks off and says, now you have a drill to sort that out, you know, and he walks off, you know. And that was a real, you know, and that's a real, you know, his attitude was kind of like, you solve problems by doing, you know, so like, don't sit there thinking next week I'm going to pass that ball quicker. He's like, just get out and do a few reps on it. And he'd do them with you. And that was also, because you'd, as a scrum half, as I said at the start, like being calm mentally is really important. So if you're worried about a skill, his approach of just going out and sorting it out on the field, like actively, as opposed to watching it in a video and writing it down. Now, he's big into, you know, solving it physically, not necessarily writing down notes and keeping them and reading them before the game. Like, two approaches would be, one, don't like wait till the guy moves, pass it straight away, and then you read it before the game and you go out and try and do it. And the other approach would be to get the bin out and practice a few times during the week, so when it happens at the weekend, it happens naturally. Yeah. So you need a bit of both. You know, you have coaches who do 24 hours analysis, and you have Sean who relies a lot on doing and delivery and getting people in the right emotional state. And there is definitely room for both. You know, the game has gone, you know, a certain way in terms of the hours the coach has put in now. But Sean's approach was very helpful. And he also was very much on the kind of, you know, the nine as a kind of a confident center of the team, and that your behavior and the way you carried yourself kind of pushed out into the whole team. So if you were like over aggressive, kind of angry man, then that's the team might end up like that. And if you were a nice, calm individual, like you can see from Connor, you know, over the years, he's certainly been calm and delivered a very good temperament, which the teams around him have had, you know, in the main, the overall team, you know, had that kind of coolness about him. So that's a good example. And in Wasps, there was a different emphasis for scrummas, in that like you had to be a major threat all the time. So like if I came off a game and I had 100 passes done in Ireland, that might be perceived as a real positive for Leinster with the back line we had. In Wasps, I'd be actually called out on, why haven't you run here and here? And you need to, the teams are watching us. And if you don't run, you know, next week, you know, teams aren't going to mark you and there's more space. So I would have been under pressure to make breaks and run when I was in Wasps than I was in Leinster. And again, that would have been Sean driving that again. So, you know, he had a big impact at a point when I was probably very open to coaching. And it was just after, you know, rather than being like in, you know, hyped up, you know, person who's just got the first contract who feels the world's at their feet and, you know, isn't open to being coached, I had just been like, you know, so I arrived in a good spot, and certainly that was very helpful. And Ian McGeachan was brilliant. You know, he would have really given you confidence in yourself and your team. In some ways, very like Declan in terms of the confidence he gave to the team and the consistency in a team. You know, and allowed us to find our rhythm and leaders develop within the team and kind of let the team lead where we were going. So between those two, I think they were huge influences on me and certainly helped me both enjoy my rugby and develop it.
That's really all that is fascinating. And one last quick one in Edwards, because I, you know, we all associate him with defence, both with Wales and France. I thought when you talked about the influence he had in you, it was going to be more defence. So it was really interesting to get the scrum half angle. Is his defensive system just, you know, incredibly sophisticated and technical, or with him, is it more attitude?
So like the straight answer is like, so when I got to Wasps in 2004, I think it was, like that, and had been for 2 years. And now, like, you've seen teams adapting it now, like, you know, France are doing it now. I mean, that's, you know, 16 years ago. So to say he was ahead of his time, you know, some people wouldn't give him that credit because they were doing it in rugby league, but like the trophy they won, and in particular, you know, I don't think there's any mistake in some of the consistency in big games and the correlation between a good defense in a big game and that being your weapon and your ability to roll that out in a big game, and the chances of it not showing up in a big game are all very low, or like the chance of it not showing up are low. Whereas if your ability is like, you take England at the World Cup where they tear New Zealand apart in attack and then they show up in the final and that doesn't just flow the next week, you know, whereas you take South Africa who delivered defensively in the semi, they show up and they deliver defensively again in the final.
It's more deliverable under pressure.
It's more deliverable, and you know, on a bigger stage you get more aggressive, you get quicker off the line. If they're all things you deliver you know, you deliver better on, you hit harder. Like, they're all parts of that defense that actually just get nudged on a little bit in a big game. On the contrary, you know, staying calm and passing the ball under pressure and making good decisions, making reads within attack. Like, in defense, fair enough, you have to make those reads as well, and that can be hard under pressure. But again, the faster the team are moving forward, and sometimes it makes those decisions for you. So I think, going back to your original question at World Cups, and you mentioned Wales specifically, like, there was some crazy stat when I was finishing up at Wasps in our last final. It was a Premiership final, like, about how many finals we won in a row. And I, you know, you kind of went out thinking, you know, no one has cottoned on to the fact that this defence is what actually is such a nice comfort blanket for us all to have in these finals. We know it's going to show up. We know what we're doing. The other team are all talking about playing all week. We're not going to, you know, they're all saying all the things we love hearing them say, you know, and there's something in that, I think. And it's the same, like, the international rugby is almost made for it. You know, you watch, because they're each game is so big and so important, Six Nations, that Sean can do that every week for 5 or 6 weeks. Same with the World Cup. You know, you have games where you can peak, quarterfinal, you can absolutely deliver on defense. So maybe, you know, he was a huge influence on the defense. And I think maybe there is something in that in the teams that have delivered at World Cups. You know, I think their defense is a huge thing. And, like, Ireland are coming back now, but we're in a great spot in terms of the intellect we have in the country now in defense. You know, you look at what Stewart is doing with Leinster, and you've got Andy Farrell in Ireland. There's no reason why that can't be part of the plan as well.
To round this off then, and going back to Leinster, did every fibre of your Limerick being shudder when you put on that blue jersey for the first time?
No, because, you know, I will support both Munster and Leinster now, right? I'm from Limerick, and, you know, I have great friends playing for both teams still. But at the time, like, to be perfectly honest, you know, they had absolutely devastated me, and I did feel hard done by. So playing for Leinster was, you know, the start of that. I was absolutely, you know, welcomed with open arms by the staff, by the players, which was a big thing for me. You know, which is a huge thing for me, how quickly they were, how welcoming they were, and by the fans. And I think, you know, I loved playing against Munster when I played for Leinster. Like, they were my favourite games. I loved going down to Thomond Park. You know, I loved winning in Thomond Park when I played for Munster the few times that it happened. And I absolutely loved winning in Thomond Park with Leinster when it happened. And I loved the fact that after the game, you know, you'd be walking down the tunnel and you'd hear a few Limerick lads shouting, like, "Well on," or whatever. And that was like, the match is over. Yeah. And it felt like the people got it, that, you know, like, I grew up wanting to play for Munster. It didn't work out. And my time, I had found a new place that was, you know, incredible. Really enjoyed it. You know, I was very lucky in the coaches I had and the group of players I played with, you know, to be a part of that kind of era and you know, to learn from fellow players and see, you know, coaches kind of arriving one after the other, driving on new things and you know, and even you like the best players in the world, like, constantly learning and seeing how important that was for teams to continue growing. You know, like, having Joe as a coach meant that, you know, people who'd won Heineken Cups before he joined were still motivated, because even in September, you know, you're learning and you're finding out something new. And you've gone from a point of sitting in a dressing room after a Heineken Cup final thinking, "Oh, this is great, I've arrived," to, "Oh, Jesus, you know, this guy already knows more than I do." And I think that across the, having that experience for those years in Leinster was you know, I was very lucky.
Yeah, so like Schmidt's been talked about a huge amount, obviously, and you're banned from telling me things like attention to detail or, you know, a breakdown specialist and the set piece moves and all of that stuff and the video reviews on a Monday, because we kind of know all that a little bit. What did he do for your game, or is there something that you remember learning from him and thinking, geez, how have I gone through X number of years in my career without knowing that before?
So I think what dawned on me was, so if you step out of the detail that he was coaching, like, I think what dawned on me was that his ability to give a team confidence in a game plan, and if you were ever to be a coach, how important that was, right? Secondly, that people kept learning all the time. Even the best players in the world, he would coach them. He would not sit back and let Brian or Johnny or dictate, you know, like, in a team meeting, you know, the correct way of doing X and Y. You know, Joe would say a step ahead, and having that, and so all the things you mentioned there were his way of stepping ahead at that time, you know. Like, so he was ahead of us because he knew how important discipline was in terms of, you know, basics was before we did. So we didn't decide our basics were going to win. He knew that getting us to focus on that was, so it was about seeing, being, having the foresight to see what was needed, is, it was his skill, you know. And he recognized a plan that would work in that period in rugby, and he delivered on it. And I think the skill for any coach anywhere is to keep staying ahead. So how do you actually notice what's important now? Because there, if discipline and entering rucks was important in 2012 for winning European Cups, I can assure you it is not what's winning European Cups now, because yeah, everybody is now doing that and there's something else happening. So his ability to stay ahead for that long and to be winning 2000 or to winning World Cups or hiding cups early in the decade, and to be beating New Zealand late in the decade, was extremely impressive. And I think that would be, so looking at it in a bigger picture, staying adaptable, knowing what's important, staying ahead, was his biggest skill, you know, and keeping a team learning and moving forward. And ultimately, you know, his harshest critics will say that's what you know, happened at the end, you know. Like, well,
you've taken the next question, you know, the obvious question was, did he stop staying ahead in terms of the trends?
Well, and then how much is their obsession with planning to a World Cup actually hurt that? So do Ireland have to sit down in January 18 and decide how they're playing in a World Cup in 18 months? And really, do they? Because the experience before this World Cup would have told us we do. But that needs to be looked at. And you know, a group of coaches sitting down and planning impeccably how to deliver at a World Cup, there's nothing wrong with that. If we need to, you know, if Joe's feedback comes back, I mean, it would be excellent feedback, and I think it would be helpful for people moving forward, for sure. You know, and that, but it's very hard. Like, you make decisions that keep you ahead all the time. So if you're a very good coach, you probably make those decisions, get them right 85% of the time. At some point you're going to get it wrong, and that's human nature, and unfortunately that has to be okay. You step up into the big picture, that has to be fine. If Joe had another three World Cups, I'm sure you know he'll do them better than he did the first two. So yeah. But I do think, you know, if I was advising, I do think it's important to keep that awareness that you know what the coach is delivering, it's not the actual skill he's delivering right now that's going to keep him going. It's the fact that he can deliver on this one and then spot what's important next and stay ahead of the game.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I guess it was very unfortunate that, you know, it all happened when it did, as in you beat New Zealand end of that year. No one was saying on January 1st, 2019, we need to rip everything up. You know, things were looking in good shape. I have two last quick questions before I let you go. So one, I know I've heard you speak about this before, and it's interesting. I would look at the Pro 14. I think a lot of people would. And in the main, for a lot of weeks, it doesn't really capture the imagination. I don't watch Premiership rugby week in, week out. There are only so many hours in the day. You've played in both. And we maybe overestimate the quality unfair in the Premiership a little bit and deride the Pro 14 a little bit. You've played in both.
Yeah, so there's a few, I suppose, simple facts. Like, you know, like you have, I don't know how many, you know, newspapers, take the newspapers, the written media, for example, and how many you have in the whole of England, say. And they have 12 teams to worry about every week in the Premiership. And I think there's a real sense of, you know, let's buy into the Premiership and let's hype it up and actually like realize that our own kind of lives and jobs and everything are important in this environment, being the Premiership thriving. And you'll see BT with the same, like the BT without the Premiership is not going to deliver on their rugby. So there's a kind of understanding that, you know, they will big it up, and then, you know, the players will feel part of it, the fans will feel part of it, and then they deliver. And not only that, when you, there's so much, because there's 12 teams, they can focus on the good news stories, because three or four of the teams have played really well every week. Sure. And then they can focus on those. So they don't have to go on about the negatives too much. And if you flip that to Ireland, you know, you've got like all of our written media, and I'm sick and just, you can expand this out yourself, but I'm just, for example, on the written media, they've only got four teams they can worry about. They're not going to write about the Scarlets and Glasgow, really. They're going to write about the four Irish teams. So my feeling is that it's more, you know, I need to write about Leinster this week and they were terrible. So there you go. Leinster were terrible and the competition is no good, as opposed to being able to, just by the way it's set up, to be able to focus on, you know, entirely on the best three teams that week, which the UK media could do. So I feel like there isn't a realization that, you know, a Pro 14, a competition in its infancy needs to be looked after, like, carefully by all the stakeholders. And the media are a huge part of that. And, you know, not looking after it when it's at its critical stage. So if you look back in 50 years and look at the Pro 14 in the first 10 years, you'd know that's a critical stage for it to succeed. And not having that kind of realization that we're all players, fans, TV, print, are all stakeholders in this actually, you know, surviving, you know, and individuals then taking advantage of. And look, people will come at me and say, that's not fair, you know, and maybe there's only the odd individual who in a certain week, you know, I'll make a headline here. And this is more about my numbers on Twitter than it is actually the bigger picture of the.
I think in the main, the coverage is pretty fair. I think if there's a complaint with it, it's that actually it's not that Leinster or Munster or Connacht or Ulster in the main are the problems. The problem with it is that the other teams are not competitive enough. Leinster can send out any team they want against pretty much any team in the competition, home or away, and more than likely win. And that's actually not a cause for celebration across the Irish media. I think if anything, yeah, we're bemoaning the lack of competitiveness, you know?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. If you're talking about the competition, yeah, I would agree with you. The other teams aren't good enough, right? That's for sure.
When I say like Premiership v Pro 14, that's what I'm getting at.
Well, I was looking from a player's point of view.
The Irish provinces are sailing through it. You know, that's actually the problem.
Yeah. So the reason why I was talking there about the player's point of view is from a player's point of view, it was like the Premiership was easier. Right, and higher reward. It's bizarre. And then you come and play in the Pro 14, and it would be like if you weren't winning by like 75 points or 50 points, you were actually, you know, playing in a tougher game, or winning by 30 or 40 points, but it wasn't good enough because it was a different dynamic because of what I said about, you know, good stories, bad stories, and the difference in the numbers in the media. But I agree with you. So you're 100% right. Looking at it strictly as a competition, the Premiership is more competitive than the Pro 14, and that's definitely an issue. How you address that, you know, it's interesting to see what Wales have done now with some of their selections. You know, they seem to be definitely trying to make sure some of their players come home and play in Wales. And, you know, I think possibly Wales and Scotland being stronger on you know, people playing for their country, playing in those provinces is important. And maybe that'll help the league a little bit, trying to think of one possible solution.
Last question. As I understand it, when you retired in 2016, you took a whopping 8-week break. I mean, they say take some time. So 8 weeks, and then suit and tie went on, and you started working with Avalon. And I know they've got an initiative at the moment to try and get some PPE into the country, which you can tell us about. But that segue into dull, horrible corporate life, you can't say that, but I'm just telling you how it is. Has it been tough? Like, do you miss the game? Like, there's some incredible highs that you just can't replace. Day to day, do you miss the day to day existence of a pro rugby player?
I don't. And this could be a few reasons in that. Like, one could be that I outstayed. Like, I played for as long as anyone could hope to, really. You know, I was 35 when I finished, and I didn't feel like I'd left any of my energy out there or anything. Secondly, I suppose I was lucky enough that, like, I retired to join Avalon. And, you know, felt like I left feeling, have I let Leo down? Have I let Joe down a little bit early? Does he need someone as a third choice or cover off the bench for the start of next year? And that's a very different mentality to be leaving with than normal. And like, not when I was expecting to leave with. And a lot of that is luck. I mean, you can't predict when another opportunity that's you deem equally, you know, or you deem as more of an opportunity or something you want to do more than what you're currently doing when you're a rugby player. So, I was very lucky in that regard. And so I left with that kind of feeling of, I hope I haven't let them down, kind of almost checking in with them, making sure they were all right, as opposed to any sort of ill feeling or anything, which, and a lot of that is like, I don't think you can plan for that. I think it's just luck. And I was lucky in that front that I had found something like Avalon, you know, which was in a strange way, you know, as kind of a, at the time, like at the company, it was about 170 or 80 people. So not huge, you know, high performance in what they were trying to do. So it's an aircraft leasing company who deals with airlines all around the world and helps them with their fleet. You know, airlines buy aircraft and they lease aircraft, you know, in kind of equal measure now.
Right.
So, and a lot of that is, a lot of my job now is working on a project for 3 or 4 weeks that's either successful or not. And I'm in a team who try and make that project work or not. And we win together and we lose together. And it is, you know, there are equal highs and equal lows, not so much in front of 80,000 people or anything like that, but in terms of effort and energy put into these things that you try and make happen for you and the airline.
But that's good, because sometimes I think what sports people find tough about the real world is, one, it moves a bit slower, but two, there are no moments where you either win or you lose. You just kind of can, in many jobs, trudge along a little bit and suddenly 10 years go by and you can miss, you know, well, we can draw a line and say, well, we sort of won that project or whatever. Yeah. So maybe there's a slight parallel there which might keep you sane.
Yeah, and you know, teammates, like people talk about the dressing room, and like I think that's probably been almost replaced as well, because you'll be in, I'll be in a team of 5 or 6
right.
people that I'll have to, you know, that I so we're all working together as equals, but as the person who faces the airline, I'll have to lead the team in terms of how we approach it, when we meet, how we meet, you know, what's the mood of very similar things through a week in rugby, like, you know, are we all clear in our roles, and you know, who's making decisions, all simple things like that. And like the relationships and the people who I'm working with are all, you know, in similar ways, very, very good people. And I'm very lucky that that's happened. So that has softened the blow, and maybe that's led into why I haven't missed it. You know, and there was, you know, something we were all quite proud of yesterday, whereby they, like one of our aircraft was coming back, you know, from China for work to be done on it. And, you know, again, the company, much like Leinster would have been, is certainly built on values and a value system. And I know you'd heard about Joe with the pillars and all these similar things. So for me to walk into an environment like this, you can imagine, was quite reassuring, where, you know, you had your day-to-day work, but you had values underpinning all that. And certainly helping others and investing in environment was one of them. And yesterday was a great example, where they flew home, you know, PPE from China, one of our aircraft that was coming back, you know, from a project that only started 10 days ago, to get a, and that was literally people in the company getting together saying, could we do this? How will we do this? Reaching out to who they knew around the world and getting it done in 10 days. So it was a huge outcome. And the reason I mention it is that they're going to do it again now. So the team in Asia are starting up again. You know, and I'm new to Twitter now, so I don't know how to actually.
The man who is a rugby player avoided Twitter has finally succumbed.
I finally succumbed today, yeah. And
well, I know your handle is @_Redden, so people can check out the details there. And you have a measly 3 followers. I kid you not when I say you've just set up Twitter.
Well, I've stayed very much under the radar until...
Until
you followed me today, Joe.
So @own_Redden, people can check your Twitter and they'll be able to see what they need to see, because you've tweeted all the details, so they'll get it there.
Perfect, yeah.
Okay. Listen, that's good to hear things are going so well, and it's good they're pitching in. I guess everyone needs to do their bit at the moment. Thanks so much for doing this. I'm sure you're running around doing various other things as well, and we might check in, I'm sure, again at some stage in the future. But Owen Redden, for the time being, thanks very much.
Cheers, Joe.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.